It's Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly, and the reason I gave a slightly more complete forecast than usual is that our topic for the show for most of the week, at least in part, has been the Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival, the first annual planned festival. And weather, of course, is a factor here because there are many things that are scheduled to be outside. There are many things that are under a tent. There are many things that are inside. And there are contingency plans for everything to be inside. So it is a rain or shine event. But, of course, they're hoping for the best weather. And I'm sorry to say that the mostly sunny doesn't come in until Sunday. But that is the way it is. And it doesn't look – there's no forecast for steady constant or nasty rain, or even thunder showers, for that matter. So that is good. The one of the early acts on the festival, which opens tonight at 5 o'clock, is a group called Dennis Stromat and Creole Stomp, a Cajun dance group. That is tonight from 8:30 to 10 at the Independent Media Center. And they are with us. Some of their members are with us in the studio. They'll be on the later portion of the program playing some live tunes for us. And on Saturday, among the many, many, many options for you are some storytelling at the Urbana Free Library. One of the storytellers is Kim Sheehan. She is professionally assistant director for education at the Spurlock Museum on the University of Illinois campus. And she somehow got into this storytelling thing. She has joined us for this part of the show. Thanks for coming in, Kim.
My pleasure.
So how did you get into storytelling?
That is a story.
Well, tell it.
In May, in the early 90s, I was doing a tour at the Old World Heritage Museum. The old museum was a large rectangle, and about halfway through it, I realized that this class did not want to be there. I'd learned it actually much earlier than that, but finally, by the time I got halfway through the tour, I realized I had to do something different. It was May. It was hot. The kids didn't want to be there. The teacher didn't want to be there. So halfway through the tour is the large Laocoon statue. It's an ancient Greek statue of a father and his two sons. It's a very violent looking statue. They're being killed by sea serpents. It is a story from the end of the Trojan War. So I sat the kids down and the teachers in front of the statue. I told them the story of the Trojan War, and by the time my story was finished, their jaws had dropped. They were totally engaged. They were so happy the rest of the tour, and I became a storyteller.
Just like that.
It was the best way to get people connected with artifacts and cultures, is by telling the stories that go around them and give them context.
What was the general age group of the kids?
Sixth graders.
Sixth graders,
yeah.
And have you generally focused your tales towards children or anybody?
I love telling to all ages. I really, really love it when adults realize that stories are for them as well. Our storytelling guild here in Champaign-Urbana actually has a series we call The Teller's Art, where we have series of performances just for adults so that they realize that they can enjoy them as well. And there are stories that are appropriate only for adults, not because they're dirty in any way, but just because they have a very mature take on them. And they can be so incredibly moving. And if you don't have the opportunity to be able to tell those stories, it can drive you crazy. So yes, lots and lots for kids, but adults as well.
So you had no inkling before this moment that you were a good storyteller?
Mm-mm. And I had never thought in terms of being from a family of storytellers or anything like that. Most of the tellers that you talk to who do this professionally talk about the fact that their mother or their grandmother or their father always told stories. I have realized since becoming a professional teller that most of what my father does is tell stories. But it wasn't, you know, folk tales or anything like that, but just whenever he talks about an episode in his life, he tells it as a story. So I did have that family member. I just never realized that's what was happening until it became a part of my life, too.
So he just did that in the course of talking to people?
Mm-hmm.
Or not in a professional way?
Mm-mm. He did. If I ask him, how was your vacation? It was not, we went here, we went here, and we went here. It was stories. You know, it gave me, again, the context of what was happening and how he was feeling. And it really was a big picture of what was going on.
since in a way the World Heritage Museum, which is the predecessor to the Spurlock Museum, was your inspiration for telling stories. Tell us a little bit about the World Heritage Museum, or the Spurlock Museum.
The Spurlock Museum is a museum of world cultures. We have five feature galleries. One is on Native North and South American Indians, one on ancient Greece and Rome, one on Europe, one on Asia, and one combines Africa with ancient Egypt and ancient Mesopotamia. And then we have a temporary exhibit gallery. Tonight is the grand opening for our latest temporary exhibit. It's called The Transforming Arts of Papua New Guinea. It will be from 7 to 8:30. So if you want some free food, see some really cool stuff, hear a short talk by the curator about what the stuff is all about, we're open.
So this is competing with the Folk and Roots
Festival. Yes, it is.
You're not quite competing with yourself, since you're not doing anything until Saturday.
Well, very luckily, we had talked about my doing something Friday night, and it was like, I'm sorry, there's already things going on.
Do you have to, if you know you're going to do stories, do you have to prepare yourself?
Oh,
or
yes.
Do you just have a bunch of stories that you have got in your head and...
Every storyteller has a certain group of stories that could be told at the drop of a hat. In fact, a very famous storyteller named Janice Del Negro, who was here at the Center for Children's Books for many years at the U of I, told us in a workshop once, you have to have a story that you can tell if you're sick, if you're hungover, if you are just not in the mood. You have to have that one story that will always bring you out of that and make you ready to tell another story. So everybody has that one. And then everybody has a certain bag full that, again, they could tell at the drop of a hat. I have maybe in that category 40 stories. My mentor, Dan Ketting, who is also here in town, claims to have 350. And he's been doing it professionally for 30 years. So I figure I've got a few years to go before I have to have 350.
So he's got almost one for every day of the year.
Exactly. And he claims he can go into a school and challenge the kids, give me the name of a country, and I can give you a folktale from that country.
No kidding. So how did you go about starting, once you decided, hey, I apparently know some stories or I'm good at telling stories, how did you go about collecting them?
Basically, a lot of them come from books, but you also get them from other tellers. You know, 398.2 at the library is, you know, one of my favorite places to be. A lot of it has to do, as far as the museum goes, with looking at the artifacts. We have a program that I do called Stories Around the World, and we found it's been a wonderful way to introduce really small children to the museum, because if you're telling a story that goes with the artifact, it helps put it all together and create that appreciation we want for the artifacts. So basically I started by looking at the artifacts we had and finding stories to go along with them. But as I went professional, and will do this for anybody, you know, who'll hire me, then I was able to even broaden that further and find stories from around the world that didn't specifically have to do with artifacts in the museum.
So tell us a story.
Okay. We're now getting into ghost story season. In fact, if I may plug a couple of ghost story events
here
in town. On the 13th of October from 6 to 8 at La Gourmandise in downtown Urbana, there will be Scary Stories on Maine. And that is Dan Ketting and Kathy Brinkman and Camille Bourne and myself telling ghost stories for those 2 hours. It's a $5 cover, and then we hope you'll bring, you know, some more money and actually have dinner there and sit with us. And we've been trying to do something at La Gourmandise about once a month. So we've been having a really good time coming up with different themes. I just did a program there last month called The Dog Days of August. And so, you know, all the stories were 2 hours of dogs. But on the 31st of October at the museum, we're having two concerts. One is from 2 to 3:30 in the afternoon, and that's non-scary stories for kids and those who don't want the very scary stories. It's a $5 suggested donation. And then in the evening at 7:30, we have So You Think You've Heard Ghost Stories, which is for people 16 and over, and we're very serious about that. These are the really scary stories, and it's a $5 admission. The tellers will be Dan Ketting and Kathy Brinkman and myself, plus students from the graduate student Library and Information Science department. So it's going to be some professionals and some amateurs, but amateurs who've, you know, been working very, very hard at this, taking the storytelling class with Dan Ketting. There'll be food for both of these events. There'll be candy at intermission in the evening one, and then all the kids who come to the one in the afternoon will walk out with their own little bag of candy to start their Halloween trick-or-treating. We're very, very excited about both of them. So, since this is the Halloween ghost story season, I thought I'd tell you a little short story.
By all means. This is Kim Sheehan, who is going to be among two storytellers, well, at least two, at the first annual Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival.
There'll be four of us. Oh.
So you and Camille are doing together.
We're doing together in the morning. There is, all of these are at the Urbana Free Library. There's a set from 9:30 to 10:15 with Camille Bourne and myself, and then we'll be doing a second one from 10:30 to 11:15. Then from 1 to 1:30 is Kathy Brinkman, and 1:30 to 2 o'clock is Linda Dust. And then at 3 o'clock, I'm doing a workshop on how to tell stories for preschoolers. And that is for anybody in the general public who is interested. If you've got preschoolers that are children or grandchildren, if you work in a daycare center, if you're a teacher, you know, come on down. And you will actually, by the time the workshop is over, my goal is that everyone will have learned three stories that they could just walk out and tell.
Okay. Yay. Let's hear it.
Okay. This is a story from China called Aosheng Meets a Ghost. Aosheng had been told all of his life that the forest nearby was filled with ghosts and you really shouldn't go in there, especially at night. Aosheng was brave, and Aosheng decided he wanted to meet a ghost. So, very late one night, he went into the forest, and at first there was enough of a moon that he could see where he was going, but the further he got into the forest, well, the darker it got. And finally, as he was walking, he heard a noise behind a tree, and he stopped. And the next thing he knew, there was this feeling on his shoulder like somebody was right behind him, and a voice said, "Who are you? I've not seen you before here." Aosheng turned around. "Who are you?" Aosheng asked. "Well, I'm a ghost." And Aosheng decided to say, "Well, I'm a ghost too." See what the ghost would say. And the ghost said, "Well, I've not seen you around here before." Aosheng said, "Well, I'm a new ghost. I just died." "Well, it's very nice to meet you," the ghost said. And the ghost asked Aosheng, "What are you planning on doing tonight?" Aosheng said, "Well, I really hadn't thought about it much. What are you going to do?" And the ghost said, "I've decided I'm going to go scare somebody, and I'm going to scare a very, very particular person. I've heard there's a person in the next village, and his name is Aosheng, and that he's not afraid of ghosts, so he thinks. So I'm going to go and scare him and prove he's not as brave as he thinks. Would you like to come with me?" the ghost asked. "Of course," Aosheng said. "I would love to come with you. I would love to learn how this is all done." And they moved towards the village a little bit. Aosheng said, "I've heard of this Aosheng person before, and so I know exactly where he lives. I'll take you there." And after they'd gone for a little while, the ghost said, "This will be much more fun if we can make a game or something out of our travels. How about we take turns carrying each other?" Aosheng said, "Fine." The ghost said, "You get on my back first." So Aosheng climbed on, and it didn't take more than a few feet before the ghost said, "You're a very heavy ghost." Aosheng said, "Well, I told you, I'm just newly dead, and I haven't learned all the things that I need to know about being a ghost, and floating is one of those things. It sounds like you've been a ghost for a very long time." "I have," said the ghost with pride. "Well," Aosheng said, "would you be my teacher? Would you tell me all the things I need to know and show me so I can be a good ghost?" And the ghost thought for a second. He was very flattered. He said, "Well, of course I'll help you." After they moved for a little bit longer, the ghost said, "You really are very heavy. We're going to have to trade places now." And Aosheng said, "Fine." And the ghost got on his back, and Aosheng couldn't even feel him. He was so light. And Aosheng said, "I bet as a ghost, there is absolutely nothing that we're afraid of, that there's nothing a human being could do that would make us scared." The ghost said, "But there is. There's one thing. And you've got to know this." Aosheng started whispering, "Too, what is it?" "It's human spit. Whenever a human being spits on us, if we've changed our shape, we will keep that shape, and we can't get out of it." "That's very scary," Aosheng said. "So we have to be careful when we're scaring somebody to kind of stay out of the way." "Thank you. That's a very good first lesson," Aosheng said. So they finally made it to the village, and Aosheng took the ghost to his own house. And the ghost floated in through the wall, and Aosheng let himself in through the front door. And as soon as they got inside, Aosheng said, "What are you going to do to scare this guy? Obviously, you know, if he says he's not afraid of ghosts, he's probably a very brave person. What are you going to do? What have you thought of? And the ghost said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to change into a horse, and I'm going to walk right into his bedroom and put my nose right up to his, and when he wakes up, I'm going to complain that he's not giving me good enough food. That is going to scare him a great deal. Ashang said, ah, brilliant. I would have never, ever thought of that. What a wonderful idea. And as soon as the ghost turned into a horse and started to walk into Ashang's bedroom, Ashang spit on top of the ghost. And for many, many years to come, Ashang had a very good horse to do his work for him. And that's the story.
And we knew that was going to come somehow or another. It just went. Or we assumed that was going to come.
Exactly.
So is that the moment when the ghost learned that
Ashang was not a ghost?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm very interested in what happens later in the story that isn't in the story. Could the horse continue to communicate with, is it Ashang?
Ashang. I really don't know. They don't say. And that's one of the wonderful things about story is that you can work with them. They're malleable. You can make them what you want. You try not. There's a big discussion in storytelling in do you change the ending of a story? One of the best examples is Hansel and Gretel. Do you get it so that at the end, the witch doesn't die? And even though people are telling it to children and they say, we don't want the witch to die and there to be a lot of violence because, you know, we don't want the children to be scared or anything, one of the scholarly things people say in the storytelling world is the fact that, but the witch has to die. Because if the witch doesn't die, she's still out there in the forest. And that's scarier than having her killed at the end, which is the traditional ending of the story. So people do try to change them, sometimes for the good, sometimes for the better. But having an ending like that, knowing what kinds of things your audience wants to know about, is exactly what makes your stories better. Every time you tell a story in front of an audience, you get better with it because you understand that it's a two-way street and their reaction is just as important as what's coming out of your mouth. And stories can change as you're telling it because you see what your audience needs or what they really want to hear from you. And if you can think on your feet, your story gets better and better and better. Because you have taken all of that information and you've been able to use it.
Well, I sort of asked the question about what happened later for two reasons. One was just to know if you thought about the stories beyond where they go. You know, if you imagined.
I don't often. There are a couple stories that I end with. The story doesn't say, but I believe. And I will add a bit to the end of the story to take it where I think is a logical ending. And often if you're reading books of folk tales, the ending is the weakest part. It's the part that you'd need to do the most work on to get it to a place where you've, you know, finished with the climax, but you know that there's a definite place where the people who are listening know that you're at the end. So yes, a couple times I've had to add things to it, but more often than not, what I'm concentrating on when I'm putting mine together personally is the story that's there, is it logical? Does it make sense? So that what I find is that if I'm listening to a story and somebody says something that doesn't make sense to me, I've lost about the next minute and a half of the story because I'm trying to figure out, well, when did that person come in? Or why did that happen? And so I lose the flow. So I really want to make sure when I'm telling a story that everything I say makes sense so that people can stay with me the whole time.
And the other reason was just curiosity whether children, especially after you have told a story, whether they start asking questions as I did. Well, what happened? What does this mean? You know, what happened to so-and-so then later on?
Not usually. The question you mostly get is that true? And my usual answer is the stories are true to the people who tell them.
You, as you were telling the story, you didn't use a lot of gestures.
I do when I am telling in front of a group.
That was going to be my question. It was also interesting to me that the reason we heard that microphone bang and the cup twice is that as you were talking to me about the story, you were using gestures, but not during the story.
No. I was basically concentrating on your face and getting what reaction I could from you. But I knew I was in a small space, so I was physically concentrating on not while I'm telling the story, banging anything. But no, I've been told if you tie my hands, I can't talk.
So did you get anything from my face? I've often been told I have quite a poker face.
I think you're completely right that you were, I could tell you were listening intently, but I wasn't getting any feedback in terms of you really liked that or you really didn't like that. So I didn't do much to change the story.
Just curious, because I was listening intently because mm-hmm. I'm not very good at remembering things mm-hmm. that people say mm-hmm. unless it's also written down.
Right.
And so I did lose the first part of the story, I think, until I got into the mode of that kind of listening and just mm-hmm. sort of concentrating. So that's probably what was going on.
And gesture often helps with that. I've had people tell me that I draw a picture with my hands. I create spaces so that people know what I'm talking about and where I'm at and where my focus is at. And so I know that that does help. But as I said, I really didn't want to hit the equipment around here and have you go, you're making a lot of noise for people.
And then you did it anyway.
I did it anyway, yeah.
Well, it is a small space, as you said. And here we're talking with Kim Sheehan, who is, in her other life, assistant director for education, appropriately enough, at the Spurlock Museum on the University of Illinois campus. She is going to be one of four storytellers participating on Saturday at the first annual Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival that will be in downtown Urbana. It actually opens tonight at 5 o'clock. One of the performers in the opening show is going to be in our next segment here in just a moment on Live and Local. And then later on tonight... this is Friday already, isn't mm-hmm. it? Yeah, so that starts tonight at 5 o'clock. Later on tonight at 8:30 is going to be a Cajun band called Dennis Stromat and Creole Stomp. Dennis Stromat is here and part of Creole Stomp, mm-hmm. One of whom is the fellow who's opening, Matt Torino, who's been on our show a few times. So they're going to be, they're in our studios warming up, and they're probably just waiting for us to finish up, and we can go talk with them and hear some playing. So I appreciate your coming in.
My pleasure.
I enjoyed the story.
Good. Come hear more.
I would like to. And that, again, you have the first round at 9?
First round is 9:30 to 10:15, then 10:30 to 11:15.
This is tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning. And all of these are at the Urbana Free Library. Then Kathy Brinkman from 1 to 1:30, Linda Dust from 1:30 to 2, and then I'm doing the workshop on how to tell stories to preschoolers from 3 to 4:30.
And if you want that repeated for yourself visually, if mm-hmm. you can't remember, as I can't, it's all at cufolkandroots.org. And all of the schedule is there. There's a lot of things going on at once. And as we said earlier, it's all rain or shine. Mm-hmm. Much of it is indoors, so you needn't be afraid of the rain. There's plenty of parking downtown Urbana. And those things scheduled outside will move inside somewhere. And there's
usually
a big
in the
tent
IMC.
As well. Much of it is free. Some of it requires some payment. The easiest mm-hmm. and cheapest and best bargain is to just buy yourself a wristband. Mm-hmm. And that covers everything that has any cost.
But all the storytelling things are free in the library, so you don't need a wristband to get in for those.
Thanks again.
My pleasure.
Appreciate you coming in. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Dennis Stromat and Creole Stomp in just a moment. Support for our broadcast today comes in part from the Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival, September 25th and 26th. That's today and tomorrow. In and around downtown Urbana, the festival features over 70 artists performing blues, jazz, old-time, Cajun, bluegrass, and Irish music with storytelling and more. Schedules and information at cufolkandroots.org. That was music by Louis Morrow Gottschalk, who was actually a New Orleans composer, called, The Banjo, a Grotesque Fantasy, he called it, with pianist Philip Martin here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. And I played that because we have some music whose style originates in New Orleans and surroundings, some Creole music, Cajun music, Zydeco music, which is actually leading to what will be my first question, from Dennis Stromat and Creole Stomp. They're going to be performing tonight at the Independent Media Center as part of the opening night offerings from the first annual Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival. And they are Dennis Stromat, who's vocalist, fiddler, accordion player, probably more, and Rob Crum, who brought with him his guitar, but also bassist and other things, and Matt Torino appearing yet again on Live and Local. This is what, your fourth?
Third. Yeah.
I'm sure we'll get to four on the fiddle. And there are other members of the band as well. Thank you all very much for taking time to come in on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Sure, it's good being here.
So my first question really has to do with some of the maybe definitions and differentiations, if you can even make them. There's Creole, there's Zydeco, there's Cajun. What's a part of what?
Well, how much time do we have today?
keep it short, man.
And if you have samples of all three, or at least, right, we can illustrate too.
Sure. I guess
this is Dennis Stromat. Yeah, am I saying your name right?
Yeah, Dennis Stromat. Yeah, yeah, that's my. Well, actually, I mean, in Louisiana, there are actually kind of like two major forms of like traditional French music that people know when they think of. They either think of Cajun or Zydeco. And essentially, Cajun music is the music, a lot of it's very fiddle, accordion, guitar, bass. It's the old traditional music of the white French settlers of Louisiana, but specifically the Acadian French, people who came from Nova Scotia at the end of the 1700s. And their music sort of developed through the 1800s in a different format from different other forms of music, you know, German influences as well as Czechoslovakian, English, and even Spanish influences on the music would result in what you have today, in some African as well, would result in what you have today known as Cajun music. Whereas Zydeco music is really the culmination of probably early Cajun influences as well on the African Creole population of Louisiana. Those Cajun influences in a lot of ways begat Creole music, black Creole music in Louisiana, which was also based on the fiddle and the accordion, but they also used scrubboard too, whereas Cajun would only use a triangle. And that eventually in Creole music in Louisiana sort of begat other forms of music such as modern day Dixieland, early New Orleans jazz came out of the Creole communities of New Orleans. And at the same time, they were all these people, also some of them played fiddles and accordions too. And eventually the 1920s and 30s, as music became more electrified, whereas Cajuns tended to keep somewhat on a straight line of traditional French-based music, you know, with the fiddle and accordion and guitar, Creole music sort of went the route in a lot of ways of blues and jump blues and some swing, utilizing the accordion, dropping the fiddle, you know, scrubboard, adding electric guitars, electric bass, drum sets,
horn sections. In some
that's
cases.
Right. In some cases, with people like Clifton Chenier and Hiram Sampey, people like the Bad Habits, people like this in the 50s, using horn sections. So adapting, not only using some of the old influences of the New Orleans sound, but also influences from the country, southwestern Louisiana sound in Zydeco. And so those are the two, you know, Cajun and Zydeco are the two major forms, one being sort of the white background French and Zydeco being from the African background. But then there's this music that sort of sets in the middle between it, which is black Creole music or African Creole music, which still is perpetuated, although only by a few people in Louisiana today, because it's the older rural tradition. And it's one of the things that we, as Creole Stomp, kind of cover all of the traditions, you might say, but a lot of times have fun with delving into the Creole tradition as well.
Well, why don't we, before we talk further, have a sample of something?
Okay, well, let's do just a, we'll do a standard Cajun song for you. This is one that, one of our this is one of our greatest hits. Something called La Porte en Arrière, or The Back Door. This is a pretty typical Cajun song. Have something called La Porte en Arrière, or means The Back Door. That's a song by a guy named D.L. Menard from Louisiana, Cajun song.
And performed by Dennis Stromat and Creole Stomp here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. They're playing tonight with the full band from 8:30 to 10 at the Independent Media Center in downtown Urbana, part of the first annual Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival. So am I correct? There's going to be more guys in the band tonight.
Yeah, we'll be tonight we'll actually have drums and electric lead guitar tonight, and we kind of mix it up. It kind of allows us to do some wide arranging material, you know, including some blues, you know, and some Louisiana swamp pop, which are forms of music that are also very, very prominent, you know, in Southwest Louisiana.
Swamp hop.
Mm-hmm.
Swamp pop. Swamp pop is kind of like.
Did you say swamp hop or swamp,
swamp
pop?
Swamp pop.
Okay.
And it's really kind of the Louisiana flavor of rhythm and blues.
And this is Rob Crum speaking.
That's right. So there's several songs that people, you know, may or may not know and identify as swamp pop, but one of them that I can think of is a song "Sea of Love," mm-hmm. which was a huge hit, way back when. But maybe most recently done by Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin some years ago. Mm-hmm. He'd had another big hit with it. But
I wonder what's his connection to the swamp.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, he's did the record with Alison Krauss. He's pretty well versed.
Yeah, there you go.
A lot of people know the song too. I found my thrill.
Yeah, sure.
On Blueberry Hills. That's also actually a swamp pop song.
No kidding.
A lot of people don't know that Fats Domino, which is spelled with an N with an O, actually is not. It's actually the original.
You're gonna
spelling.
Tell me EAUX or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. EAU or EAUX.
Yeah.
But it's actually French, and a lot of people don't know this, but Fats Domino speaks French.
I had no idea.
Yeah, he's a Creole.
And where's he from? That? He's not from New Orleans, right?
He is.
Okay. I thought he was like.
Well, he's from actually the Manchac area, which is outside of New Orleans.
Right.
But,
okay.
You know, but he's in that area, you know, and he's part of the oldest Creole generation, you know, still living that speaks some French, you know, in and around the area, you know, along the West Bank over in New Orleans area. But part of his music, you know, that he was coming up with, you know, really was in a lot of ways, a lot of people don't know that rhythm and blues sound, a lot of it that was really formatted and became such a national form in the 50s, in a lot of ways was Louisiana based, you know.
I have learned yet another thing on this show, and I hope our listeners have too. This is Live and Local. You're, Dennis, from Southern Illinois,
mm-hmm.
originally.
That's right.
Grew up around here, Indiana, a little bit?
I live about 2.5 hours south of here. And I live about 20 minutes from Kentucky, 10 minutes from Indiana, and that's kind of where I'm located.
And what's your connection to this music?
Well, trying to make the long story short, which is hard to do too, but actually, as a kid growing up where I grew up, I grew up about 45, 50 minutes from Vincennes, Indiana. And, of course, some people know that that's an old French Creole town and a lot of French Creole families there, but white Creole, not African. The original French settlers, you might say, of southern Illinois, southern Indiana, southeast Missouri, that came here 300 years ago. I was quite familiar with some of their events that they had in Vincennes when I was a kid in the 70s. They have rendezvous there. They used to even have, for a few years, they had what they call the 12th Night Balls, which were 12 days after Christmas. They were an old French custom, which they still carry on, actually, over in places like Pré de Roche, Illinois, or some people call it Pré de Rocher in southern Illinois, or St. Genevieve, Missouri. These were all French Creole towns, and so I ended up really got interested as a kid in that tradition. And so that kind of led me into southwestern Illinois and southeast Missouri, where there actually still is a living French Creole-speaking population. There's not very many today. When I came across them 20 years ago, there were around 400 or 500. Today there's less than 50.
And that's where?
Then southeast Missouri. It's west of St. Genevieve, about an hour south of St. Louis, in an area called Old Mines. And I learned to play fiddle there, actually, for the most part in the late 80s and the early 90s, and when I was, like I say, in my late teens. And so it's where I learned to speak the language. And one of my friends there actually had lived in Louisiana, and joking one day, because I was so, you know, just really interested in learning more about the culture and learning more about music and being around it, he was like, well, you know, if you're so interested, he was joking, he said, you should go down to Louisiana. He said, there's actually a few more French speakers down there than there are here. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, they're down there. They're called Cajuns, though. he said they're called Cajuns because he said we're Creoles, but he said they also have Creoles down there too. And I was like, but he didn't tell me the story about the difference between Creoles in Missouri and Illinois and Indiana and Creoles in Louisiana. I had to learn that on my own. But he told me I should go down to Louisiana. Well, I got down there, and yeah, there was a few more down there. At the time, there were about 500,000 French speakers.
Compared to 50 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Compared to 400 at that time in Missouri. And, you know, and so that's how I got involved in Cajun and Zydeco music. Was going to Louisiana. I ended up living there and working there and became friends with a lot of people.
And did you know French pretty well before you went or picked
it
up when you were
I knew Creole French. You know, pretty well, you know, Illinois Creole, you know, Illinois, Missouri Creole. It's different than Cajun somewhat, you know.
So they could probably sort of understand you sort of.
Oh, yeah. There was really not a whole lot of problem. You know, there were certain words that maybe I didn't know that they knew and certain words that I used that they found strange in Louisiana. They knew it was French, but they just thought it was funny, you know, in Louisiana. And, of course, that's just one level. You know, that was just going from Missouri and Illinois Creole to Cajun is just one level. Then you yet have to still deal with the French speakers from Canada and France, you know.
And when did you start picking up the music side of things?
Well, I learned the music, like I say, Missouri, Illinois, French music, I learned in Missouri, you know, in southwestern Illinois. But down in Louisiana when I was working at a place called Vermilionville, we had bands every day that played at a historic site that I worked at. In fact, one guy was a fiddle player that I used to hang out with, one of the two Fontenots that I knew, a guy named Merlin Fontenot. He's about 90 years old now. He's still alive, but he played for years with a guy named Joel Saunier, who's kind of a famous Cajun and Cajun country player. Anyway, I hung out with those guys a lot every day. And you know, down there, you know, 20, you know, I don't know, you know, it was almost 18 years ago, you know, 17 years ago, I guess, you know, down there at that time, the communities were still had a lot of older people in the communities who spoke French. So it was really fun, even my age, because I spoke French. I could go out to a lot of jam sessions and hang out with a lot of these people, you know, and got along with them because I spoke the language. You know, they sort of let me in, you might say, the door.
Why don't we hear maybe a sample of a slightly different style?
Yeah, let's do a little. Let's do a Creole song, more specifically Creole. We were playing around with it. We've never actually played this song.
It's live, making its debut
out on a show. But this is an example of a little bit more rhythmical Creole style song. Some called Fipa Tu Sa. This comes from the Creoles around Durald, Eunice, Louisiana. Yam chasse, c'est la frappe. C'est un trapin. Thank you.
Oh, fais pas tout ça. Fais pas tout ça. Fais pas tout ça. Viens me chercher, c'est à me réjouir.
Dennis Stromat and Creole Stomp here live in our studio on Live and Local on FM 90.9. What was the name of that tune again?
It's called Fais pas tout ça. It means don't do that to me.
There's a particular, before I ask you a couple of questions, just for those tuning in, Creole Stomp's going to be at the Independent Media Center in downtown Urbana tonight at from 8:30 to 10. They're part of the first night of the first annual Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival. For information on the complete schedule, go to cufolkandroots.com, and there is an awful lot going on, and the event happens rain or shine. There's a drizzle expected, you know, pretty kind of off and on throughout, but no
tonight,
serious rain.
Tonight everything's inside.
Oh, it is.
Everything is inside, yes.
Good, so we're covered there. That's Rob Crum, by the way.
Thank you.
I'm going to take a brief break and say that on Monday's show, we're going to be having also a special treat. Guitarist Tommy Emmanuel is going to be on the show with us live in our studio with along with singer-songwriter Rick Price. They're performing Tuesday evening at Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield and giving a workshop on Monday. So we're all excited about that.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, that's going to be a treat.
Really, he's terrific.
Yeah, to say the least. Yeah. He was at the Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign earlier this spring and had a chance to talk to him on the phone. Now we get to have him in person on their way to Springfield, which will be a lot of fun. For many reasons, I wish that this show were on TV. There's many reasons I'm perfectly happy it's not, because I can wear what I want. but one reason it would be nice if it were is to get a nice view of your accordion.
Oh, yeah.
Dennis, because this is the third very different accordion we've had on this show now. We've had a bandoneon from Argentina. We've had a big old button accordion. And what is this thing?
Well, this is actually, if you want to get the technical term.
It's very colorful.
It's melodeon.
Ah.
They call it a melodeon. But it's actually just very simply called a Cajun accordion. And it's a single row Cajun accordion. It's a diatonic accordion.
Single row, meaning just one row of key buttons.
One row, yeah. Essentially have a couple octaves here, you know, with it. And, you know, but you're based on, as the chord structure is based on, you can only actually play in a couple keys with one of these. And, it's got a bass box side for those out there in the listening audience. It's got the right hand is where you play all the notes, all the melodic notes are being played on the right hand, and you've got a left hand that plays bass notes as well. And actually, in the old days, a lot of times the whole band for some house dances would just be this accordion and maybe a triangle, and that would be it. You know, or, you know, sometimes it might be the accordion and just a fiddle, and that would be it. And a lot, you know, and you would hear the person pumping out the bass with their left hand, you know, for the dancers to give the dancers some kind of a foothold.
So you got a beat,
yeah. Yeah, there was a actually an accordion player in Louisiana who's very, very famous. That last song that we did, something called Fais pas tout ça, is actually from the Ardoin family in Louisiana that I've spent many, many years hanging out with them and traveling with them and touring with them, playing fiddle for them mainly, and I learned to play accordion, I learned to play accordion from them, but they had a cousin in the family by the name of Amadé Ardoin. He passed away back in the 1940s, but he was well known for playing these house dance, 6-hour house dances, just him with his accordion. And he was quite, became legendary because he could play all night long, you know, and they didn't need a band. He was the band.
And he would retain the audience.
And he would retain the audience the whole night.
See, that's the miracle.
Yeah.
A whole, to some people, you know, a whole night of accordion, and there were still people left at the end, right?
Yeah.
We have time for one more tune. Wish
right.
we had half
let's
the day
little,
here.
Let's do a little Zydeco.
I see that Matt put on his armor. Mm-hmm. He's got the washboard that he kind of hangs over his shoulders. Does that have a technical term?
The cheese grater.
The cheese grater.
Scrub board.
The scrub board.
Yeah.
You'll hear the sound of it.
Yeah.
It's Dennis Stromat Creole Stomp with Rob Crum and Matt Torino here on Live and Local.
Let's let Rob sing a little something. Okay. Let's do, how about some Paper in My Shoe?
Okay. Yeah.
I got a paper in my shoe. I got a paper in my shoe. What your mama don't know, what your papa don't allow. I got a paper in my shoe. Paper in my shoe. I got a paper in my shoe. What your mama don't know, what your papa don't allow. Got a paper in my shoe.
What could the name of that one have been?
Yeah, that's Paper in My Shoe. It was really the first big Creole or Zydeco hit, really, in the 50s by this gentleman whose name is Buzu Chavis. Well, it was the first hit for Buzu. And he actually recorded that. They sold a lot of records. It was a big hit, but he basically laid down the accordion for years and really came back not until many years later. He was one of the best accordion players. He's a little Creole gentleman from Lake Charles, Louisiana. He was great.
That's kind of a fun song. I could probably remember the lyrics to that tune. And I have a little trouble with lyrics.
And see, that's one of the things that kind of denotes the difference of Zydeco from like Creole music and Cajun, is a lot of Zydeco music is done in English, actually. And some of that is because Zydeco in Louisiana, in a lot of ways, would go hand in hand with a lot of blues music and in the blues clubs. And where a lot of the young African Creole artists were wanting to take the music that they grew up with but try to find another audience with it, is they utilized blues to get to that other audience, and then they did the songs in English to sort of bridge that gap, that language barrier, you know.
Learning yet another tidbit,
you know,
about
I think it's also
music.
Worth mentioning that Zydeco as a form of music is really, it's a post-World War II form of music. And a lot of people don't know that. So it's really really mainly due to a gentleman named Clifton Chenier and his brother. And they actually were the people who designed that scrub board that all Zydeco bands play now. Before then, people play that traditional washboard. But years before that, really, whether the music was being played by the Cajun community or the Creole community in Louisiana, people just referred to the whole catalog of tunes as French music that they were playing. And that French music really is continued to be played today by Cajun bands, by Creole bands, by Zydeco bands.
Well, there's a lot of history we could pick up on if we only had a little more time and then
sure.
hear a lot more tunes. But I appreciate your coming in very much today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. And thanks for featuring so many of the Folk and Roots Festival artists during the week. Your shows have been great, and it's been really nice of you to feature those.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to do it. And Rob Crum's on the steering committee for the CU Folk and Roots Festival. And I hope it's a great success.
I hope so, too.
Thank you all for coming in.
Thanks a lot.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly.